At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. When a crime case grabs my attention, I find myself struggling with the excitement of it all. I feel guilty. But I've come to realize that it's okay to be fascinated, to have your imagination captured by anything, even the spree of a serial killer. Curiosity leads to discovery, which makes an adventure, and adventure brings excitement. So to be excited while researching, writing, presenting a crime case, it's only natural, I suppose. Just like killing women that remind you of your mother. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Ripper of Ypsilanti. Washtenaw County, Michigan, July 23rd, 1969. The university town, locally known as Ypsi here in Ypsilanti, has been terrorized by the frequent and sadistic murders of young women for 2 years now. Co-eds, mostly, in this time before Kemper or Bundy became infamous for doing the same. The Ripper of Ypsilanti is thought to be on the hunt for brunettes, usually those known to wear dangly earrings. At least that's the gossip. In such small towns, the wives of police officers will each spill a little tea that eventually pools into a pot for the townsfolk to sip at, whether it be served at the bar, the beauty salon, the church, or the diner. The townsfolk will get their fill, and then some. Young brunettes with dangly earrings have been turning up horribly murdered. And have you ever heard of such a thing? You have, I have, but at the time, have you ever heard of such a thing? They haven't. Of course, they will hear tell of similar killers not too far in the future. But for now, Ypsi is alone and they're concerned for young co-ed brunettes. But there's more. A juicy detail that the cop wives can't help but dish. Every victim to this point has been on their menstrual cycle. He's thought to be young, handsome, able to charm a girl into his vehicle or onto the back of his bike before whisking them away to a brutal fate that will inevitably end with their broken body defiled and dumped in the rolling hills of a back road heaven. Thick brush, beer cans, and abandoned old farmhouses. The final victim, 18-year-old Karen Sue Beineman, will be reported missing on this day after having been fitted for a blonde wig to cover her brunette hair. Wigs by Joan is the name of the shop she goes to, and inside, Karen shares that she's experiencing two firsts this summer's day of 69. For one, Karen has never worn a wig before, but she'd been bothered to by concerned family and friends due to what had happened to all those girls locally. Beyond the wig fitting, and this is really silly, she's almost embarrassed to say it, but the second thing is that she'd accepted a ride from a tall, dark, and handsome stranger on a motorcycle while making her way to the wig shop just now. He's outside, and this is all very exciting. The ladies in the shop don't think so. They find this highly irresponsible, disturbing. They find it disturbing that a man on a bike would pick a girl up who's a brunette, and that a brunette would accept a ride from a man on a bike in an area where a guy on a motorcycle is picking up brunettes and murdering them. Karen is fussed over and fit to become a blonde, while the killer lies in wait. And though he's posted up in the shade, leaning up against his bike, he can feel his ears beginning to burn in said shade as the gossip inside Wigs by Joan turns to the gruesome. July 9th, 1967. Mary Therese Flezar, a 19-year-old accounting student studying at Eastern Michigan University, goes missing while walking through what is locally known as the student ghetto in Ypsilanti. Mary is well known back in her hometown of Willis, Michigan. She's bright, pretty, a joy to be around, an honor student, just out of high school with a passion for music. She's a big fan of the Beatles. Mary's parents lose touch with her this day, and eventually police are rolling through the student ghetto asking questions. At one dorm, they get an answer. The witness recalls seeing Mary walking in the sun, being followed by a blue-gray Chevy. The man in the vehicle had been talking at his window to Mary, and she had been shaking her head, as if rejecting an offer for a ride. 1 month later, on August 7th of 1967, two boys stumble across a naked body at an abandoned farm. It is badly decomposed, but dental records confirm it to be the corpse of young Mary Flezar. She had been stabbed over 30 times in the chest after being beaten and tortured. A sexual assault was more than likely, but impossible to confirm due to the condition of the body. Both feet had been cut off, along with a part of the hand. The killer returned to the site multiple times. There was evidence that the body had been moved around, which was initially perplexing, but soon realized to be the result of the killer continuing to have had his way with the corpse, like a tiger returning to its kill. That's the only way investigators can think to compare the behavior. The golden age of serial killing had not yet shone its light on such grisly actions. At the funeral home, a young man described as handsome with dark hair, driving a blue-gray Chevy, showed up soon after the discovery, claiming to be a relative of Mary's, there on behalf of the family to take a picture of the body for a keepsake. When he is told that it's not possible, nor in any way appropriate, the young man becomes angry, quote, "You mean you can't fix her up enough so I could just get one picture of her?" End quote. The disturbing incident is reported to police, but nothing comes of it, though it could, with enough questioning of students. Investigators might have used their only solid lead to find that the killer, currently waiting for the girl in the wig shop, is known to drive his mother's blue-gray Chevy, his prostitute mother, with the dark hair and dangly earrings. He matches the sketch made from the recollections of those present at the funeral parlor, and maybe that's why the young killer fails to strike again until the following summer. June 30th, 1968. 20-year-old Joan Schell misses her bus. The art student needs to get from Ipsy to Ann Arbor to see her boyfriend. Joan is a pretty brunette, and it's not long before a blue-gray Chevy pulls up to offer her a ride. Her roommate has been watching from their dorm window and believes she knows the man who picks Joan up. His name is John Norman Collins, a local frat jock known to pick up girls on his bike from time to time or in his mother's Chevy, an attempt to make out, usually a successful endeavor due to his good looks and charming nature. Joan Schell does indeed make it to Ann Arbor, but that's not until a week later as a mutilated corpse on the side of the road. Like many of the victims, there is a stripping of the flesh of the torso, mainly focused on the breasts. She has been beaten and stabbed, though this time the victim has her throat slit, ear to ear, as they say. Also, her blue miniskirt is twisted around her throat, which tells you that he is prolonging his pleasure at her displeasure, choking and then slitting. The body is little blood beneath it, and the body appears to have been kept indoors for a period. The top part is more decomposed than the bottom part of the body. He had the bottom part in a cooler area than the top part, and they're not sure exactly how that went about, but he was preserving the bottom part while watching the top part decompose, maybe? She likely had been kept and tortured somewhere before being dumped. The corpse most likely had been defiled the same way as the previous victims had been. Joan Shell's roommate is questioned, which leads to her tip on John Norman Collins. John, who is staying in a house directly across the street from where the victim was stolen, 22-year-old John Norman Collins, who we will get to, he claims to have spent the weekend of Joan's disappearance with his mother in Center Line, Michigan, and he is believed on this. Collins is the nephew of a police officer and doesn't seem to be the type anyways, though he matches the sketch almost exactly. March 25th, 1969. After a year spent believing just about any other murder in the general vicinity has to be related, the so-called Ripper of Ypsilanti strikes again and embarrasses the Ypsilanti police force. He leaves the body only 200 yards away from the previous victims in Ann Arbor, Michigan. 16-year-old Marilyn Skelton is found behind a vacant house. She was last spotted in front of a restaurant days previous. There had not been a whole lot of panic when she'd gone missing. Marilyn was known to use and sell drugs. She was a police informant and was thought to have run away with a man and gotten up to no good somewhere, which was in a way true. The 16-year-old is found like the others, naked, beaten, stabbed, tortured. This crime scene is a little different, somehow worse than the others. The young woman's skirt has been stuffed down her throat, and a large branch has been shoved up into her vagina. There's also evidence that she'd been beaten with a leather strap, and like all these victims, if I fail to mention it before or after, have been beaten about the face in an incredibly violent way. And it's from this hideous point in the story where the killer got bold and began slaying at an escalated clip. April the 16th of 1969, only 3 weeks later, another young victim, this one egregiously so at just 13 years old, is discovered in the woods surrounding Ypsilanti. She had been savagely raped and murdered like the rest, a handkerchief stuffed in her mouth to muffle her screams as she was tortured. Of note, her genitals were mutilated, and I believe this happened with most of them, but it's not widely reported. But they focus on the 13-year-old to really let you know how bad this shit is. An electrical cord was used to strangle the middle schooler. She's in 8th grade. It's used to strangle her in the end. Don Luis Bassam had disappeared walking home from a friend's house. She had last been spotted using a train-tracked shortcut through the trees of her neighborhood, just as the sun was setting on Ipsy. The Ripper had taken her to an abandoned farmhouse out in the woods, nearby where her body was discovered. This was confirmed by the little girl's orange sweater, confirmed meaning that she had been in the farmhouse at some point but was found outside of the farmhouse. Her orange sweater was found in this abandoned house, and glass shards in the basement matching those found in the soles of her shoes, as well as her knees and her elbows, further confirmed that she had been in this shitty abandoned house and tortured, raped, what have you. Some believe the eighth grader escaped through a broken window in the basement at one point, but she obviously never made it to safety. This farmhouse would later yield clues that led investigators to believe it had been used for the previous murders. Blood and a dangly earring belonging to a previous victim, 16-year-old Marilyn Skelton, would soon prove this. Gossip got around, and the result would be that the farmhouse, likely full of further evidence and a potential trap to stake out and wait for the killer to return, because he would return to his bodies, this place would be burned to the ground by some fucking idiot. Investigators believed that the killer had torched the structure, as five clipped lilacs were found placed neatly in the driveway leading to it. Because there were only four victims to this point, not five, I believe some hero from town committed the arson. The gossip was five, but the reality was four. 23-year-old law student Jane Mixer had been kidnapped, strangled, and shot in a graveyard. A copy of Catch-22 placed by her side back in March of 69, right in the middle of the Ripper's reign of terror. It would take decades to find through DNA evidence that the killer was not the same. But the Jane Mixer case, with its quirks that captured the public imagination, her body being placed on a grave, jumper pulled up to reveal undergarments, no sexual assault, yellow raincoat placed over the body, the Catch-22 paperback, oh, and the murder, you know, was thought to be part of, to this point, the Ripper's streak. You know, a five-victim killing streak that an unknown subject thought of as a multiple murderer in this time before the term serial killer was coined, had committed. But back to my point. It's unlikely the killer burned down the abandoned home out on the outskirts of Ipsy, the one he'd been using as a slaughterhouse, as he'd left the 13-year-old victim in plain sight by the road. He left all of his victims in plain sight. He wanted them to be found. He didn't mind that the structure, and with all of its evidence, was going to be found, in my opinion. There are stories from other girls that they've been picked up on a motorcycle by the dark, handsome young man still waiting in the shade with his ears engulfed in flames outside of Wigs by Joan. I must keep my own shaky structure intact here with my storytelling. The girls said they've been brought to this spot, to this structure that ends up getting burned down after they find the body of this 13-year-old girl. And they said they'd been brought out to the spot before it was lit up. And the young man who had brought them there would say to them, quote, "Yeah." When they asked if this was where those girls were killed, and he'd say, "Yeah. I find it kind of peaceful here." End quote. John Norman Collins is the man I'm quoting here. 22 years old. University of Eastern Michigan student. And he would make out with chicks out there. He didn't kill them all, you see. But he's only ever been convicted of one. And that's the one in the wig shop. And we're getting there. Just one more before we go. Hemingway talks about killing his darlings. And often when I'm writing, Hemingway wrote fiction, right? But often when I'm writing, I've talked to other crime writers. And they'll say, you know, I'm almost done this story. I just have to kill a few more. And that's harsh, right? And it's kind of like gallows humor. That's the way I feel with this story, that I'm, you know, rehashing and re-killing these girls as I walk through it. But again, you know, we're getting there, and there's just one more to kill, for him to kill, and for me to rehash before we go. Oh, no, sorry, two more. But, you know, police, have a seat out here by the old house before some dumbass torches it. It's peaceful out here. Out here just outside of Ipsy, by this abandoned structure where he raped, tortured, horrifically. I have not gone into it enough, but he would lash them on their breasts over and over and over again. Like they were torn up and raped horrifically and strangled and then let go and then brought back to life in a time before that was popular. He was making this shit up. It was just inherent to him. It's not like he had watched a Netflix documentary and copied somebody. This guy is an originator of serial killing, what he did to girls and what Bundy and Kemper and, you know, all the rest would do later wasn't based on what he did because they didn't know about him, but it's almost like instinct to do the things he was doing to these girls is the same that, I'll just point at Bundy. Bundy is very close to Collins. What they're, you know, motivated to do. But have a seat. Have a seat by this abandoned house. You know, there's no wonder the previous owner abandoned this house. It's too far from anything. There's no doubt with the many blankets of greenery around us and only a lone dirt road to get you here, and then you have to come down a path to get you beyond that dirt road, you know, miles from Ipsy, that this would be a cozy, peaceful place to bring back little girls and, you know, young women, co-eds, to brutally torture and sexually humiliate. It's just a damn shame we couldn't get a better idea of how many before some moron decided the best way to deal with an ongoing multiple murder case would be to burn a warehouse full of potential evidence that we have behind us. This thing's gone now. Somebody from town burned it while they were investigating the evidence inside of it. They burned it to the ground. Oh well. Their heart was in the right place, more than what could be said of me. It's a lot of murder, and I'm moving through it quick, ripping through it. What happened to that 13-year-old girl, Dawn Basem? What happened to her out here? I really can't blame whoever burned the place down for wanting to make a statement. Hell, the way this shit was being handled, it's likely the Ripper would have used it again had it not been raised. This episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack and hydration sponsor here at Dark Topic. And we're so excited to announce they've teamed up with Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, on two special edition products, a salted caramel chip protein bar and a yuzu mango hydration mix drink. And I've been eating a whole hell of a lot of salted caramel chip protein bars. I don't get sick of them. That's one thing I'll say about those. It's a great treat and decent for you, as well as the yuzu mango hydration mixed drink. I mean, I'll have one before bed. I'll have one when I wake up in the morning. Something about it. I mean, really great flavor and makes me feel like I came back to life after I chug one of those bad boys. IQ Bar's plant protein bars, they're mixed with clean, delicious ingredients that keep you physically and mentally fit. The salted caramel chip IQ Bar that I've just mentioned there, it has 12 grams of protein and only 1 gram of sugar, and it has brain-boosting nutrients in it like lion's mane, adaptogen. The Yuzu Mango IQ Mix is a refreshing zero-sugar hydration mix that marries bold flavor and essential electrolytes for your body and lion's mane plus magnesium for your brain. Just mix with water for Michelin star taste and next level hydration. 10% of sales, I should mention, go to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, which supports the next generation of aspiring U.S. chefs. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, clearly I didn't drink my yuzu drink this morning, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. This is the snack that you should start stocking in your cupboards when you go to reach for that, you know, ice cream at night, that chocolate bar during the day. I'd suggest reach for an IQ bar. They sent me the salted caramel chip IQ bar, the yuzu mango mix. And I mean, again, I've been going back and forth on those and I just can't believe that something so delicious could be so good for me. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% of all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text DARK to 64,000. Text DARK to the number 64,000. That's DARK to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Could this be your summer of discovery? Yeah, with Rosetta Stone it could be. Whether you're traveling abroad, planning a staycation, or just shaking up your routine, what better time to dive into a new language? With Rosetta Stone, you could turn downtime into meaningful progress. Rosetta Stone is a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. I've been using it to try to learn Japanese, as I mentioned already multiple times. I mean, Rosetta Stone and I are good friends at this point, and I'm surprised how quickly you can pick things up in bite-sized lessons. And what I mean by that is, like, if you're planning on going somewhere or interacting with someone who has another language underneath their belt or a country that is required to speak that language wherever you are in certain situations, you can pick up bite-sized things to get you by. And I really like that about it. And it makes you feel like you are learning when you haven't developed the entire scope of it. At least you have a foot in the door with these bite-sized lessons and learning with their true accent feature. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert. It has 30 years of experience teaching people. I mean, there's millions of users and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language growth, and you can learn faster, retain longer. The big thing with Rosetta Stone for me is that you get this lifetime membership with them when you sign on, and you just never know when it's going to come in handy. Whatever trip comes up in the future, you can prepare yourself with this in your back pocket. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential right now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com, that's Mood.com, has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. They'll deliver them discreetly right to your doorstep, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code DARKTOPIC. I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself, and it's wild how different each one feels. They're sleepy time gummies. I think I might have taken one earlier. I got to hurry this up. They knock me out in about 15 minutes flat. No hangovers, no grogginess. I wake up feeling no worse for wear. And their epic euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crappy mood. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for almost anything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, sexual arousal, and each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code DARKTOPIC. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code DARKTOPIC at checkout to save 20% off on your first order. The summer of 1969 would be a difficult one to enjoy as a student living in Ypsilanti, Michigan. For the young men, they felt uncomfortable showing any interest in girls, for fear of being suspected of being the elusive ripper. For the young women, being in Ipsy at this time was like being in a prison. Of the girls whom weren't asked to come home by their parents, back to wherever they come from to, you know, go to university there, and find another campus that wasn't being stalked by a homicidal maniac, those left to fend for themselves were advised to stay in groups. Brunettes were told to dye their hair or buy a wig, and almost every conversation that could have been about peace and love at this time of 69 revolved around murder. June 8th, 1969. 21-year-old Alice Callum goes missing while walking home from a party, and just about anyone who hears of the brunette's blunder mutters that she kind of asked for it, considering what's been going on, which is madness, which is unfair. To be living in a place and time where to walk home from a party means you're almost definitely going to be kidnapped, tortured, raped, and murdered must seem silly to a young woman, especially in a time where you don't have a cell phone. Like, you know, it wasn't the same time. You might catch a news clip, but mainly you're just hearing people warn you against it. And for a headstrong young woman, you might say to yourself, fuck you, I'm going to live my life. But this, unfortunately for her, is the time, the place, where it's truly going on. Reports come in that Alice is last seen on the back of a motorcycle, leaving the scene of the party. It's a bar called The Depot. Stores, you know, they're empty of knives, baseball bats, and pepper spray. Locksmiths are driving Ferraris around at this time. There is a reward of $42,000 put up for any information that would lead to an arrest, the equivalent of over $300,000 today. I think it's $321,000. A massive reward. But Alice didn't hear about it. You know, she's still gone on the back of a bike with a tall, dark, handsome stranger. And her body is found partially nude in a field by three teenage boys not long after. An abandoned structure sits nearby on a territorial road. It's believed to be the murder site. The killer dragged her out into the open to be found. And found she was. Imagine being these young boys walking through a field, taking a shortcut, and you find this corpse cut ear to ear through the throat. The slash so deep that it cuts through her spine, nearly decapitating her. She has been raped, they'll find, and she's been overkilled. Stab wounds to the chest have pierced the heart, and there's a gunshot wound in her forehead. Very unusual that the gunshot likely killed her and the stabs were post-mortem. There's a lot of necrophilia going on here with the first case where he went and he wanted to take a picture of the corpse. And with all cases where any chance he got, he would return to the corpse and defile it. 2 weeks later, 2,000 miles away in Salinas, California, a 17-year-old named Roxy Phillips is kidnapped from the street by a blue-gray vehicle with Michigan plates out there in California. Witnesses describe a dark-haired man driving and a girl wearing a red dress with floral print squealing for help as the vehicle squealed away. 22-year-old John Norman Collins had been vacationing out in California at this time, and he did it. A ripped swatch of that floral pattern dress would later be found on his mother's car. And I want you to meet John. I do. It'll just be another minute. He's got me running around all over the place here. And really, you know, people tell me not to apologize. But I apologize because I mean it. So my meandering tone through this is just that I've spent a lot of time with this case. I don't mean to sound bored by it. By all accounts, this is the first Ted Bundy, and never was recognized as such. So, anyways, Roxy from California here, her brutalized body would be found in the Pescadero Canyon just outside Salinas where she grew up. The floral belt from her dress was wrapped tight around her neck. She was raped, she was brutalized, beaten, stabbed. Investigators must be careful in retrieving her as she lays in a patch of poison oak. 22-year-old John Norman Collins will be on record at a California hospital at that time, having sought treatment for exposure to poison oak. I covered everything, so let's just meet John. He's been waiting so patiently in this parking lot for Karen that I mentioned in the beginning. 18-year-old Karen Sue Beineman, the girl just about to exit the wig shop, Wigs by Joan, you remember her? Anyways, while we have a moment, you know, this is John. John, dark topic audience, John. He's the one I've been wanting to tell you about, you know, the one who's been killing all the girls and whatnot. John, a little over 6 foot tall, a specimen of an athlete, truly. There's a picture of him in his underwear, and he looks like he's fucking about to walk out into an octagon, you know, with the UFC. He's often described as handsome, but on closer inspection, he isn't. Any further than 10 feet away, you could be forgiven for thinking you're looking at a tall, handsome young man, but you're not. He's slimy, long sideburns, pockmarked face, dark hair, serpent-like eyes. John Collins looks like Elvis or maybe Johnny Cash, you know, dunked in acid. Sorry, Elvis dunked in acid looks like Johnny Cash. And John Collins looks like Johnny Cash dunked in acid. But anyways, again, a strong, well-built guy that attracted women and put fear into the other male students. He was a star baseball pitcher, an honor student, captain of his high school football team. Collins entered the Ipsy College campus scene as a force to be reckoned with and soon found his place with a fraternity full of jocks. But then he'd been caught stealing, and from there he turned rebel, like Johnny Cash or, you know, James Dean. Between 1967 and 1969, he was more into motorcycles and sports, building his own Triumph with stolen parts. And he's here in downtown Ipsy doing his best to hide from our scrutiny, it seems. But in reality, he's attempting to avoid identification by the woman in the chocolate shop beside Joan's Wigs, Wigs by Joan. And she just keeps on looking in the chocolate shop. No one's coming in, so she's just bored, smoking a cigarette, looking at the window, keeps on looking at John on his Triumph bike. She's into bikes, you see. And later she'll be able to ID John as a result of a few sneaky peeks at him he's missed. Every time she looked out, she said that he would turn his head, but she would look out and spot him when he wasn't looking at her. The girls in the wig shop are nosy too. John Collins, later John Chapman, because it's hard to pick up women when you're a suspected serial killer. Wait a minute. That's not how that works. Somebody tell John that only the crazy send jail mail and only crazy chicks kind of have a thing for serial killers. You know, Ed Bundy and Ted Kemper have a tough time making conversation, but Ted Bundy and Ed Kemper? Suddenly the prison mailrooms, Victoria's Secret. John Collins had a tough growing up. His mom, described as a, quote, total knockout by one former sheriff of Ipsy. His mom was a man-eater. Every stepfather John had, and there were many, seemed to be a violent alcoholic when they weren't banging his mom. Probably a violent alcoholic while they were banging his mom as well, but they weren't brutal to her, just to him. You know, one of them used 4-year-old John as a human shield in a potential shootout. In one story, he was simply beat up in other stories. The result was that he developed a flash temper. One never quite knew where they stood with Big John when he got older, but you find yourself sitting if you set him off. And you know guys like that. I know guys like that. The thing is that they don't even know what it is that's setting them off, but the anger knows, doesn't it? Their eyes will go dark and boom. Therapy might help. But you know what else helps? Beating the fucking shit out of somebody who annoyed you. And that's what he'd do at any given opportunity. And later on, he'd go a little overboard, let's say, with his anger towards his mother, who was his only anchor after his father abandoned him as a very young child. And my hypothesis on it is that John saw his mother getting run through by all these guys. Sorry for my terminology there. But she was a prostitute, and the stepfathers came through and all that. None of them were worth it, and he probably felt abandoned by her and wanted her. So he took her in the form of his victims that reminded him of her. That's my theory. Former girlfriends reported that he was aggressive in the bedroom. And it is said he'd get particularly angry if any girl were on her period. John, in fact, claimed that he could smell it, which is interesting. The thought I have about this is that John would pick up many women and get into many a potential consensual affair, but when he found out they were on their period, he would lose his mind. And that might have something to do with his mother. Who knows? He won't talk about any of this stuff, right? And I'm not saying this is the case for every victim of his, that they were on their period and then that's why he blew up, but it might be a better explanation than him having a sixth sense for girls on their period. Like the cops, the impression I got from these cops is like, oh, he's after girls on their period. Oh, that's a clue. Guy, you can't know a girl's on her period. But what you can know is that when you're screwing around with them consensually, that they're on it and it triggers you and possibly murder them. That's the way that I see it. Anyways, now, here comes the final victim here, the one who finally got John caught. Her hair blonde now instead of brunette. John will tell you he never had a thing for that anyways, by the way. And he'd get really upset if he suggested it had anything to do with his smoking hot brunette mother with the dangly earrings. And I'm not saying that. That's that stupid cop I'm talking to you about, this sheriff. She's smoking hot. This cop is this old, you know, retired cop. Smoking hot. His mom was so fucking hot. And so was the daughter. You know, his hot sister. With the same look as the mother and as many a victim. And they're onto it there. But like as a cop later, it's like, don't call them smoking hot. Don't say that the victims were smoking hot when they're dead in the way in which we've gone through. Right. Just let me just jump in here. This is after my initial recording, but there is a interview with Sheriff Harvey in the show notes as the first one in the sources. If you want to see what I'm talking about, some of this episode got clipped. I've had some recording issues I didn't want to talk about in the beginning, which I probably should have to explain how tired I am when I'm reading this, when I'm recording this initially. But what kind of got lost there in the translation is that I'm talking about Sheriff Harvey's in multiple interviews, but the main one is in the show notes if you want to see kind of what I'm talking about with the way that he's behaving and retelling his side of the story. So John, his sister, looks like all these victims, and there's a story where he put a boyfriend of his sister's in a coma just for being her boyfriend. And he's very protective over his mother as well. Anyways, the girls that he kills resembling his mother and sister have nothing to do with a perverse incestual obsession. And if you even hint at it, John will write you a letter in all capitals to let you know that you're wrong. He will. And that's in the show notes as well. He wrote to like the press, like, how fucking dare you? All in caps. Which, you know, in a society now where we can see through that kind of thing and we know a little bit more. Every individual seems to know a little bit more about psychology. We all know a little bit about it. And John, not looking good for you. The guy's been in prison for, Jesus, what's that now? Like 50 years, right? So he doesn't know that we see through him. But continuing, he's currently serving a life sentence for the only murder that can manage to get him dead to rights on, John Collins, or No Chicks Chapman, as I like to call him. He'll explode and write long, rambling letters full of screaming words. Like I said, text seething with hatred and anger towards anyone he becomes aware of that he needs to set straight, he feels. I think rabid dogs like this need to be put down, honestly. I really do. Just like anybody, any killer who continues to appeal, who's dead to rights, and continues to appeal or reach out to the press or even try to reach out to the families, you got to kill them because they're continuing to harm the surviving victims. It's incomprehensible to me that they still get to make their brand of evil felt in the world after having been convicted of something like all this. So leading up to this last murder at the wig shop, from the wig shop, there had been a half dozen girls that day who had rejected the killer's offer for a ride on his Triumph. a rookie EMU cop. That's East Michigan University. This rookie cop had spotted his former fraternity brother. I don't think they were in the same fraternity, but they were in fraternities and knew of each other. And he recognizes John Collins as the creep trying to pick up brunettes. It's like, oh, shit, guy's trying to kill a bunch of brunettes. Maybe I should take a note of this. So when this officer, his name is Larry Mathewson, later heard that a girl had been stolen away from a downtown wig shop on a Triumph motorcycle and heard his description, it was finally over for John Collins. Unfortunately, by the time investigators caught up with him, it was also over for Karen Sue Beineman as well. Her body is found in a ravine 3 days after her disappearance from the wig shop. This is on July 26th of 1969. A doctor and his wife walk down their private drive to retrieve a newspaper. What's that, a cardinal? What's that? Oh my God, is that a Baltimore Oriole? And then she's like, was that a body? She literally says to her husband, there's a body down there. And it's very clear. She's partially naked. And her flesh is ripped away to reveal subcutaneous tissue. Karen had endured a brutal death. Cloth is found in her throat, used to muffle her screams as it had been with the others. Her throat and entire body has been burned by a cleaning agent. This is all information that comes out on this crime because this one went to court. And I'm left to believe that this was happening throughout, or at least with a few of them. You know, after the first two, he started to learn that he could destroy evidence just by dumping bleach on them. Or perhaps it was just further torture. I mean, getting bleach dumped down your throat can't be great. Or onto your torso that has been stripped away by being lashed by a leather belt. Her panties are found in her vagina with the killer's semen on them. So this is what gets me about trying to destroy the evidence. You have it on the panties. But again, we're in a time where they didn't have that DNA evidence, right? So you couldn't have known. It's tough. It's tough. Tough stuff. Those panties, though, they have hundreds of small blonde hairs on them. Over 500 tiny, small blonde hairs. And we'll get to that in a moment. The discovery of Karen's body is somehow kept secret. By this point, the FBI is involved, which helped with keeping shit a secret. And a mannequin is placed in the ravine where Karen was found. Karen's removed and they replace her body with a mannequin. And then there's a stakeout. Investigators know that the killer likes to return to further abuse the corpse. And on a rainy night, not long after the body's discovered, with the mosquitoes eating posted officers alive, a shadow appears in the ravine, spotted through binoculars by one cop. But the men who are supposed to be down there are not able to get to the shadow in time. And some reports are that the radios were malfunctioning due to the heavy rain. But a lot of people believe that those officers weren't even there because they were getting eaten alive and they didn't want to be there. It's a shit show. The press and the public are flabbergasted when they hear how the killer was missed in this trap. He came back. He was there. Exactly what you wanted. And nobody was there to fucking swoop in and grab. Where's the cop cars? Where's the fucking cop cars? You're just expecting guys who are getting eaten alive by mosquitoes in the rain to what? Run down there and try to catch a shadow in the dark. The fucking plan is... it failed. But like I mentioned, John Collins is already doomed, so it doesn't matter anyways. And it's the hairs on Karen's panties that have truly done it. John Collins had an uncle who worked as a sheriff for the FCPD. Friends would later share that John always seemed to know gruesome details about the Ripper's victims, not shared by the press. And John would later claim that this uncle of his would share inside info with him, and that's why he knew so much when he was talking to his schoolmates. That's why he would know so much is what he would say to them. During the week of Karen Beineman's disappearance, this uncle had asked his nephew, John Collins, to watch the house for him while he vacationed with his wife and two small children. Two small blonde children, whom received haircuts in the basement before the trip. A basement that this uncle had come home to find in disarray, cleaning materials missing, black swaths of paint on the floor. Upon hearing of his nephew's name coming into play, the uncle spoke to his superiors, and his basement was soon analyzed secretly. Interviews with neighbors revealed that the sounds of a girl screaming had been heard that week, which was disturbing for many reasons. Well, for only one reason. I mean, a girl screaming in the night is something you should probably call in, check out. But not, why not call that in at this time? Usually when a girl is screaming from a home while a community is paralyzed with fear due to a torturer of young women being on the loose, you'd think, and I said usually, but back then, I know it's unusual to them, but the idea of a torturer of girls being a community, and it's all through the newspapers, don't you think that calls for a call when you hear a woman, young woman screaming? It was a different time, I suppose. A time where people minded their own business, right, John? The good old days. The black paint in the basement is scraped away, revealing bloodstains, and those blood samples are matched to Karen's blood type. That's the best they could do back then, but yes, it's her type. There's hair on the floor, though, left over from the kids' haircuts, that matches the hair on the victim's panties. They can match the hair. They can tell that the hair on her panties is the same as John Collins' uncle's kids. She had died down there, and there's no doubt who did it, unlike with at least six others. When John Collins is arrested and told about the hair, he bursts into tears for a moment, a quick moment, and then he regains his composure. It's like he couldn't help it, just burst out of him, and he sucked it back in. And though the murders suddenly stop following his arrest, the clear killer never admits his guilt in any of the slangs. When they find a silver Canadian dollar known to be a missing pendant from his first potential victim's necklace in his dresser, Collins just simply denies it all. He's Canadian, too, in this case. You know, I have a Canadian dollar. What are you fucking... Who cares? I was born in Windsor. Is it really that strange? You know, he's a prick about it, knowing full well that investigators know, that Ipsy knows, who did the ripping way back when. The killer bogs down attempts to bring him to trial for more murders. He clams up, jamming the process with appeals, forcing the system to stay still with what they have on him. The best they could do is give the ripper a life of hard labor, and they do. I swear to God, there's a fly flying around my hand, and I'm sorry if you hear that. But I swear to God, the best course of action, and I say to God, my relationship with God, you know, I try to keep it straight, and I know a lot of you don't believe in God. I see it as something maybe different than a lot of people see it, but I think that we're straight on this. If you got him with those clippings on the panties, if you fucking got him 1,000%, and he's continuing to be a pain in the ass for everybody. You got him through, you know, DNA, through blood, fucking whatever. You have witnesses that put him in a lineup. You kill him. Get rid of him. Don't let him jam up the fucking process with the appeals. Don't let him drag everybody through. Let God deal with them. Or let the emptiness swallow him. The best they can do is give the Ripper a life of hard labor because of the constraints of this system, and they do that, and he enjoys the exercise, you know, up until this day, though at the age of 75 they likely take it easy on him. He's just an old man with his secrets now. You know, I said he enjoys the exercise because he was a very fit guy, and he would be showing off in the yard, fucking breaking more blocks than everybody else. Narcissist. But again, he's just an old man now with his secrets. We all know, and maybe that's enough, that, you know, the victim families who are still alive know. And maybe that's enough. Although, if you have, we all have mothers. We all have fathers. We all have kids. Not all of us, but, you know, think about the person you care about the most. And if somebody snatched them off the street and brought them to an abandoned fucking house in the middle of the woods and terrorized them, And the way he was, he punched them in the face multiple times. And he took out his anger on his mother and he said all kinds of horrible shit to them. He made them scream. He stuffed handkerchiefs into their mouth and ripped away at their breasts with a lash. And some of them tried to get away and he caught them. And think about the person that you love the most having to endure that. And screaming maybe even for you to help them. What do we do with that person who did that to them? What do? You kill them. You torture them. If you had your entire way, but at least get rid of them. And now, do we really need to hear much more of what an animal like this was capable of? Those who came after him showed us more than enough. But the Ripper of Ypsilanti was the one who opened the door. You know, he cracked the seal on a Pandora's box of prolific perverts who gained incomprehensible heights of notoriety. That's one thing we can rest on. John Collins never got his due. He wasn't a Bundy. He wasn't a Kemper. He wasn't a Gacy. He wasn't a Dahmer. He wasn't a fucking Warnos. He wasn't... who else you want? Am I forgetting one of your favorites? Am I forgetting one of your favorite serial killers? Richard Ramirez. Gary Ridgway. Who else we got? Who else is big? Like on your Mount Rushmore. Did I miss anybody there? You're screaming at me, aren't you? About your favorite serial killer. But John Collins doesn't come to your list. John List might. But not John Collins. That's the thing we can rest on. He never got his due. His name change, his resistance to admit his guilt kept it from him. They called him the co-ed killer. But Ed Kemper took that. They called him the prototyped Ted Bundy. I called him the Ripper of Ipsy. And I'm certain Michigan is just fine with the fact that what happened to their people back in the late 60s is mostly a secret. Michigan has the serial killer in John Collins. The original to the Ted Bundy, the Ed Kemper. But they're safe from that distinction because of his secrecy. But the victims, those we know of at least, we should remember their names. Mary Therese Flezar, 19 years old. Joan Shell, 20 years old. Marilyn Skelton, 16 years old. Don Louise Bassam, 13 years old. Alice Callum, 21 years old. And Roxy Phillips, 17 years old. And the final victim, 18-year-old Karen Soon Beineman, who got him caught. May they rest in peace. And thank you for listening. And here's a few more names I shouldn't forget. Shoutouts from Tier 25, as promised. Placed here in a really bad spot. Good God, this is really terrible. What a prized position for a shoutout. Andrew Young, I know you're enjoying that. Andrew, you sick bastard. Nick Parr. Par for the course, Nicky. You know how it is. Paula Forrest, my God. We're so happy that you weren't found in one. Hannah Jameson, gonna need a shot of that, Hannah, after all this. And Andrea DiRocco, it was a rocky fucking episode, Andrea. And thank you so much for all of your support, not just those at Tier 25, but for everybody who listens to the podcast. This has been Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna, and for anything I missed, please check out the show notes. There's a ton of interviews with the investigators, and there's not a whole lot of documentaries on this, but you do have a very interesting interview with Sheriff Harvey immediately available to you. I'll see you real soon. Thank you. Love you. Isaac. Love you so much. Isaac. Why do I fucking throw on love yous like that? It doesn't mean anything when you do it like that. I gotta go get my kids. Eyes cocked, doors locked. Stay paranoid. I love you.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.